This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. What happens when a president becomes disabled, physically, mentally, or both? How do we know? And who should decide? Tonight in this archive edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, in a broadcast that was first done in October of 1999, Professor of History Robert Dalek traces the history of presidential disability and offers some suggestions for coping with the problems. We'll hear excerpts from his lecture and then get responses to Professor Dalek's proposals from two men who have spent time in government in Washington, former Congressman Chet Atkins and the dean of the Boston University Law School, Ronald Cass. Here now is Professor Robert Dalek on presidential disability.
During most of the 20th century, we've lived with the assumption that presidents are miracle men, or very nearly so. As former New York Times columnist Tom Wicker has argued, quote, Americans like to think, and a history insufficiently studied or understood persuades them that for everything that's wrong, there's bound to be a solution, only needing to be found. And the quicker the fix, the better. So it tends to be with our presidents. If we just elect the right person, we can get this country moving again. Throw the rascals out, vote in the miracle man, and we can all stand tall. It'll be morning again in America. Eager to maintain as strong a hold on the public imagination as possible, presidents have not resisted the impulse to encourage such illusions. Indeed, they have had few qualms about encouraging a belief in their omniscience and omnipotence. From Theodore Roosevelt to Bill Clinton, most presidents have embraced the role of miracle worker. Woodrow Wilson's War to End All Wars and Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty are just two of the most striking examples of this impulse. Some presidents have been more modest. William Howard Taft, for example, complained bitterly that his countrymen had excessive expectations of him. He saw them assigning, quote, all the sins of omission and of commission in society at large to him, and cautioned that the president cannot make clouds to rain, he cannot make the corn to grow, he cannot make business to be good. John Kennedy may have put the most amusing face on presidential pretensions when he offered the historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. an appointment at the White House. What will I be doing there? Schlesinger asked the president-elect. I don't know, Kennedy replied. I don't even know what I'll be doing there. But you can be sure we'll both be busy more than 8 hours a day. Rather than being miracle workers, presidents have been greatly burdened by the office. In fact, only 15 out of 41 have managed to win election to more than one term. The job, as Thomas Jefferson described it, has been a splendid misery. No president leaves office with his reputation intact, Jefferson also asserted. The writer John Steinbeck saw the office as an impossible challenge that made all its occupants potential victims of a physical and or psychological collapse. In his words, quote, we give the president more work than a man can do, more responsibility than a man should take, more pressure than a man can bear. We wear him out, use him up. He is ours, and we exercise the right to destroy him. Woodrow Wilson echoed the point. Men of ordinary physique and discretion cannot be president and live if the strain be not somehow relieved, he said. Even when they have acknowledged these strains, presidents have not helped us in making sensible judgments about what chief executives can and cannot achieve. They have been even less helpful in leading the public to reach sensible conclusions about presidential disability. No president has ever acknowledged that medical or psychological problems have significantly limited his capacity to fulfill his constitutional responsibilities. To the contrary, presidents have made every effort to hide any problems that might lead the country to see them as less than able to do their job or as being in need of long-term relief from the demands of their office. Examples of presidential dissembling about their health are legion. When William Henry Harrison won the election of 1840, he was in questionable health. Age 68 when inaugurated on the 4th of March, 1841. Harrison lacked the physical stamina for the demands of the office. The country was suffering the worst economic downturn in its history to that point, and during the first month of his term, hosts of office seekers and victims of the Depression besieged him with demands for relief. On April 4, he died of pneumonia, and Vice President John Tyler established the precedent for an orderly presidential succession. Since the Constitution did not make clear whether upon the death of a chief executive, a vice president would actually become president or serve as a temporary acting president, Tyler decisively resolved the uncertainty by taking the oath of office and declaring himself president. Though political opponents challenged his reading of the Constitution, the Congress, out of a desire to assure current and future stability, endorsed Tyler's actions and helped put in place the means by which all future transitions of presidential power after the death of a president would take place. Grover Cleveland, who served as the country's 22nd and 24th presidents, hid the fact that he had a mouth cancer that was surgically removed at the start of his second term in 1893. The discovery of a malignant tumor by Cleveland's physician led to a secret surgery performed on a yacht cruising in Manhattan's East River. The team of doctors, quote, removed the president's left upper jaw and part of his palate and fitted him with a vulcanized rubber prosthesis that retained the natural contour of his jawline. The prosthesis and the absence of any scarring allowed the White House to consistently deny rumors that the president had undergone surgery and had a potentially life-threatening disease. Fortunately, the cancer did not recur, and Cleveland lived to the age of 71 in 1908. The surgery, however, was not revealed until 1917, when one of the physicians published an article in the Saturday Evening Post about the president's condition. Cleveland rationalized his dissembling about the surgery with the knowledge that the cancer was not fatal and that the surgery had only temporarily incapacitated him. He also believed that revealing an illness that called his long-term health into question would have poorly served his ability to lead the country. In a sense, all presidents have seen the public as in league with them when denying limitations on their physical or psychological capacity to govern. To admit that a president is too unhealthy to attend to the public's business is to create a crisis of confidence that can play havoc with the economy and raise questions at home and abroad about an administration's ability to deal with overseas challenges. Woodrow Wilson presents a most striking case in point. Although only 56 when he came to the White House, he had a history of small strokes that had temporarily incapacitated him, first as president of Princeton and then as governor of New Jersey. In 1906, he had experienced temporary blindness in his left eye after one of these episodes. When a prominent Philadelphia neurologist examined Wilson shortly after his election to the presidency in 1912, he told Wilson's personal physician, Dr. Carrie T. Grayson, that the president-elect was unlikely to live out his first term. The imprecision of medical knowledge at the time and the want of a precedent for an elected president giving up the office for fear his health would desert him persuaded Grayson that Wilson should not stand aside. He did not bring the neurologist's prediction to Wilson and concluded that a strict regimen of proper diet, exercise, and limited stress would allow Wilson to fulfill his presidential duties. Besides, if Grayson had recommended to Wilson that he forego the presidency in order to preserve his personal and the country's well-being, and the president-elect had rejected his advice, Grayson, under the rule of physician-patient confidentiality, would have been compelled to remain silent about Wilson's medical problems. Grayson's judgment and the confidentiality requirement ill-served the nation. Although Wilson came through a first term without mishap and won re-election, the demands of American participation in the First World War put strains on Wilson that destroyed his health in 1919, the third year of his second term. A series of medical problems made it impossible for him to be a fully functioning president. In April, while at the Versailles Conference, he had an acute respiratory illness, with symptoms similar to the deadly influenza that took so many lives in 1918. The problem sidelined Wilson from the talks for a week, and some members of the delegation believed that the president showed a permanent decline in his mental acuity following this illness. By the summer of 1919, Wilson biographer August Heckscher says, the president, quote, was a depleted man. Exhaustion, recurrent illnesses, the steady drain of untreated hypertension had taken their toll. More significantly, in July, he suffered a small stroke that kept him in bed for several days, and Heckscher believes affected his capacity to operate at optimal efficiency and was a warning of events to come. The country and subsequent presidents seemingly learned nothing from the Wilson experience. In 1932, when Franklin Roosevelt ran for the White House, he made every effort then and later to hide or at least downplay his paralysis from polio contracted in the 1920s. Would the country accept a disabled man in its highest office? He asked himself. In fact, FDR's illness and successful comeback in New York, where he was a two-term governor, gave him an unspoken advantage in the campaign and in the White House. The country, like Roosevelt and his advisors, did not want to be confronted with his physical limitations. To openly discuss problems that might arise from having a disabled president was simply unacceptable. Instead, the public assumed that FDR had somehow recovered from his illness and was able to be a full-time, unimpeded chief executive. In the midst of the Depression, the image of a candidate who had suffered a terrible, paralyzing illness and recovered from it became a kind of metaphor for what the country hoped to gain from his administration, a restoration of economic health after a terrible, debilitating collapse. Roosevelt, who made no reference to his paralysis during 1932 and successfully presented himself as being in robust health and able to stand and even walk, saw himself as having a shared agreement with Americans that they would see him not as the disabled victim of an unconquerable disease, but as a vital, dynamic president able to lead the country back to the promised land. What is striking about this is that Franklin Roosevelt, throughout his 12 years in office, never, except one time, made reference to his disability. And the only time he did it was when he returned from the Yalta Conference in February 1945, and he had to give a speech to the Congress. And he said in that address, "I know you will forgive me for sitting down as I deliver my talk. I've just returned from a journey of some 10,000 miles, and I carry 10 pounds of steel around each of my lower legs." It's the only time he ever made reference to his disability. What's fascinating, too, is if you go to the Roosevelt Memorial in Washington, D.C., you will see this statue of Franklin Roosevelt in a chair. It's not a wheelchair. The only evidence you can find that Roosevelt had this disability is if you go behind the statue and look at the bottom of it, and you will see rollers, coasters on the back of this chair, because what he had was a kitchen chair that they put wheels on as a replacement for a wheelchair, and this is what they've replicated in the statue of him at the Roosevelt Memorial. But there is now apparently talk of building another statue showing him as suffering from this paralysis, because there is this question of fidelity to the historical record, and now the impulse is to build a statue that openly points to Roosevelt's polio or disability. At any rate, the difficulty, the disability had, it was a bargain that worked wonderfully well with the American public until 1944. In 1941, at the start of his third term, Roosevelt's physician pronounced him at age 50 in fine shape, both physically and psychologically. But his doctor was being less than candid. Diastolic hypertension was diagnosed that year, and the president was beginning to show the strains of his office, particularly the burdens of managing the world crisis. By February 1943, one journalist who had followed the president for years detected a certain weariness, a waning vitality in his behavior. And then, early in 1944, He began to show signs of severe health problems. He complained of headaches, seemed constantly tired, nodded off during a conversation, and once blanked out while signing his name to a letter. At his inauguration in January 1945, after election to his fourth term, Secretary of State Edward Stettinius described the president as, quote, trembling all over. It was not just his hands that shook, but his whole body as well. At Yalta in February, Lord Moran, Churchill's physician, thought Roosevelt, quote, a very sick man. He has all the symptoms of hardening of the arteries of the brain in an advanced stage, Moran recorded in a diary. Moran gave him, quote, only a few months to live. And of course, Moran had it right. Roosevelt died on April 12, 1945. It's distressing to think that someone as ill as FDR, however popular he remained, however effective he was as a war leader to the end of his life, would have run for another four-year term with so much at stake in national and international affairs. And even if Roosevelt and the country faced a relatively quiet period at home and abroad, it seems impossible to justify running someone who was a dying man for president. Just the fact that Roosevelt never informed Vice President Harry Truman of the development of an atomic bomb is enough to make one wonder about the wisdom of having a president as debilitated as FDR. Yet the fact that no disaster came from Roosevelt's final months in office, that Truman managed to lead the country as well as he did through the next 8 years, seemed to diminish the importance of Roosevelt's illness. Indeed, the election of Dwight Eisenhower in 1952 at the age of 62 signaled that the country had few qualms about having someone serve in the White House who, at the close of his two terms, would be the oldest serving president in the country's history. Yet Ike's record of White House illnesses generated public concerns about presidential health in the midst of the Cold War. In September 55, Eisenhower suffered a heart attack. Remembering the Wilson cover-up, to his credit, he insisted that the public be fully informed of his condition. Since he had a moderate coronary incident and was making a rapid recovery, he believed that disclosure would reduce public alarm. Public anxiety was also addressed by informing the country that the vice president would temporarily preside over all cabinet and national security meetings. Since Ike remained fully capable of making decisions, the president's health crisis little disturbed the nation. Consequently, when Eisenhower, who fully recovered from his heart attack, decided to run again in 1956 at the age of 66, the country was enthusiastic about giving a popular president a second term. The amendment, which was adopted in 1967, began by confirming historical experience. Upon a president's death, the vice president would become president. The amendment also provided that in case of a vacancy in the vice presidency, the president would nominate a replacement who would require majority confirmation by both houses of Congress. Most important, it provided for the means by which a president could temporarily be replaced in case of incapacity. Power was to be transferred by written notification from a president to Congress that he was promoting the vice president to acting president. Another way to do this was by a declaration of presidential incapacity from the vice president and a majority of the cabinet or a body designated by the Congress. To regain his power, the president would need to notify Congress of his return to health. But should a dispute arise between the president and vice president as to the president's fitness to discharge the duties of his office, a two-thirds vote of the Congress would be needed to keep the president from returning to power. In theory, this has been a valuable advance in addressing issues revolving around presidential incapacity. But in practice, the amendment has yet to prove itself satisfactory. True, in 1973, when Vice President Spiro Agnew resigned to avoid impeachment and subsequent prosecution for accepting bribes, Nixon appointed Gerald Ford to replace him. Moreover, after Nixon resigned in 74, Ford used the 25th Amendment to make Nelson Rockefeller his VP. It was the only time in the country's history that we had an unelected president and vice president. Hardly an ideal solution for a nation that prides itself on its system of political democracy. In 1981, the first test of the amendment's provisions for temporarily replacing a president did not work well at all. After Reagan was seriously wounded in the attempt on his life in March, The vice president and cabinet refused to invoke the 25th Amendment. By not announcing a temporary constitutional transfer of power, the White House created initial confusion as to who was running the government. Reagan was in surgery. Bush was away from Washington. Secretary of State Alexander Haig, I'm sure some of you remember, stepped in to fill the vacuum, announcing to the press, "I am in charge." This only added to the national uncertainty about who held the reins of power and raised fresh questions about the proper procedure when a president was incapacitated. From everything we now know, Reagan was in critical condition for several days after the shooting and could not resume his full duties as president for almost 6 months. During this time, he would occasionally be exhausted to the point of incoherence, according to his biographer, Lou Cannon. As important as the failure to invoke the 25th Amendment during this 81 crisis are unanswered questions about the administration's refusal to use it during Reagan's second term. To be sure, the Reagan White House did invoke the amendment for 8 hours in 1985 when the president received anesthesia and postoperative medication for colon surgery. But broader questions about Reagan's capacity to govern effectively in 1987-88 remain unanswered. Edmund Morris, I'm sure you've heard of him, Reagan's official biographer, has stated that Reagan never fully recovered from the wounds inflicted on him in the assassination attempt. Moreover, in the last 2 years of his presidency, Reagan impressed people as having lost control of his administration. The Iran-Contra affair, for which he denied essential responsibility, may tell us a great deal about his capacity to govern in the last years of his presidency. Was his inattentiveness here reflective of an undiagnosed medical problem, namely the development of Alzheimer's, which has afflicted him in his post-presidential years? We know that former Senator Howard Baker, before accepting an appointment as Reagan's chief of staff in 1987, raised questions about the president's physical and psychological capacity to remain at the head of his administration. Baker satisfied himself that they would not have to invoke the 25th Amendment to transfer power to Bush. But the evidence on Reagan's condition and the basis for Baker's judgment is thin. We will want to know more before we reach firmer conclusions about how well the 25th Amendment worked. It may well be that when it comes to presidential incapacity, the principal lesson of the Reagan years is that even with a constitutional remedy in place, presidents are as reluctant as ever to transfer power to a vice president, either temporarily or for the duration of their terms. Presidents have understandable concern about damaging their public standing by conceding physical or emotional problems. But the loss of authority by any single president is less important than the larger national interest, which is ill-served by a disabled president clinging to power for the sake of his own future political effectiveness as a leader. To date, the 25th Amendment has been no panacea for resolving dilemmas about a president's physical incapacity. Even more difficult are problems attending a president's psychological difficulties. Our present state of knowledge and the track record of presidential performance in response to emotional strains make it almost impossible to say when a transfer of power might sensibly take place. After all, Abraham Lincoln and Winston Churchill, to take one foreign example, were beset by depressions that added to their burdens of office. But who then wouldn't have been depressed by the demands of sending so many men to their deaths in the Civil and Second World Wars? Moreover, who can imagine replacing such great leaders as Lincoln and Churchill with inferior subordinates? Any consideration of a president's psychological incapacity has to be made, I think, with these examples in mind. Yet psychological difficulties are real and can and have played havoc with a president's capacity to meet his official duties. Consider the cases of Calvin Coolidge, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and Bill Clinton. As governor of Massachusetts, during the first year of his presidency, Coolidge had been an assertive and effective leader. All the stories that come down to us about Calvin Coolidge, the many jokes, He was taciturn. He was quiet. He was remote, removed. Endless stories. He didn't talk much. Somebody said he looked like he had been weaned on a pickle. They told the story of the reporter who was told Calvin Coolidge died, and he responded, "How could they tell?" The lady sat next to him at lunch and said, "Mr. President, I have a bet that I can make you say more than two words." And he replied, "You lose." Well, this is a stereotype about Coolidge. In fact, in the first year of his term and as Massachusetts governor, he was a rather lively and effective leader. But in the summer of 1924, his 16-year-old son, Calvin Jr., died of blood poisoning from an infected blister. The loss devastated the president, who suffered a clinical depression. In contrast with his earlier political career, inactivity and passivity characterized his remaining 5 years in office. In the words of historian Robert Murray, quote, "Coolidge's administration began to crumble after the summer of 24. The president withdrew almost completely from interaction with Congress and showed little inclination even to participate in the activities of the departments of his own government. His work days began to shrink in length, and his naps grew considerably longer and more frequent. Sadly, his shrewdness turned to lack of interest, his involvement to indifference, and his well-developed leadership skills were abandoned. Can anyone doubt that the country would have been better served by a transfer of authority to a more attentive vice president, the highly competent Charles Dawes? But with no clear constitutional mandate for such a shift of power, and a traditional reluctance to unsettle the country by acknowledging any sort of presidential disability, Coolidge presided over essentially a four-and-a-half-year crippled presidency." There are reasons to believe that LBJ's, Nixon's, and Clinton's respective presidencies suffered as well from the emotional upheavals besetting the three men. Lyndon Johnson was infamously volatile, grandiose, and dominating. He was notorious for his abuse of subordinates, notable for everything from verbal attacks to humiliating incidents of requiring their presence in the bathroom while he satisfied the call of nature. Johnson's intemperateness seemed to find full expression in response to the Vietnam War. Judging from what White House aides, historian Eric Goldman, speechwriter Richard Goodwin, and press secretary Bill Moyers have said, Johnson became depressed and even, in quotes, paranoid in response to criticism of his war policies. Goldman describes Johnson as, quote, unquote, downright frightening, ranting about opposing senators and journalists whom he described as taken in by the Russians. As far as LBJ was concerned, Senator William Fulbright and journalists Walter Lippmann and James Reston were either secret communists or Soviet dupes. Goodwin and Moyers remember Johnson as so unbalanced that they discussed consulting a psychiatrist about the president's state of mind. Moyers recounted conversations to me that he had with Secretary of State Dean Rusk about LBJ's agitation and irrationality. He also says that he discussed the president's emotional distress with Mrs. Johnson. In 1966, after a meeting with the president, Fulbright told members of his staff that he believed Johnson was, quote, beyond a rational discussion of Vietnam, unquote. Fulbright believed him, quote, capable of almost any recklessness, including the bombing of China, unquote. Johnson, of course, never went that far. And his irrationality is open to debate. It's impossible to say with confidence whether Johnson should have temporarily or permanently stepped aside. And though he was rational enough to drop out of the 68 presidential race, there is disturbing evidence that he tried unsuccessfully to re-enter the contest after Bobby Kennedy had died. By then, however, his policies had done significant damage to the country, which might have been prevented by a use of the 25th Amendment. We will know more when the Johnson Library releases an additional 6,000 taped conversations covering the years between 1965 and 1969. Since LBJ determined what to tape by turning the taping equipment on and off, however, it is difficult to believe that we will learn anything that doesn't serve his historical image. But given what we have heard in some of the 3,000 conversations already released by the library, it is conceivable that we will be able to capture some of Johnson's irrationality. Have any of you heard these tapes? They play them in Washington on C-SPAN on Saturday afternoons, and they have a devoted following. Have you heard the conversation he had with a tailor? Have any of you heard this? Well, it speaks volumes about the fact that he wasn't always in command of what he was taping. He has this conversation. It boggles the mind to think that he would take this conversation. He calls up this tailor, and he says, "Are you the fellow who makes Hager slacks?" And the man says, "Yes, Mr. President." He said, "Well," he said, "damn good slacks," he says. "You made me 3 pairs last summer," he said, "and they were just great, and I want you to get me 5 more pairs this summer." And he ticks off the colors that he wants. And then he says on the tape, he says, "But man," he says, you got to give me more room in the crotch. Them pants are cutting my nuts something awful." Now, this is the President of the United States recording himself on tape, you see. So what else may he be saying? I don't know, but we're going to find out over the next few years as they release these additional tapes, and it may give us some interesting additional evidence as to the man's continuing capacity to govern. The Nixon tapes will likely be more useful in helping us assess his irrationality in the weeks and months before his resignation in August 1974. Published reports of Nixon's erratic behavior, speaking to the paintings of past presidents on the White House walls, for example, are insufficient to allow us to make a sensible judgment on Nixon's fitness to continue in office. But his 3,000 hours of unreleased tapes, which were voice-activated and give a fuller picture than the Johnson tapes of what Nixon was thinking and feeling, should be of considerable help in allowing us to arrive at more measured conclusions as to this president's psychological capacity to deal with the pressures playing on him. And what about Bill Clinton's fitness to govern as he went through his impeachment ordeal? Some commentators suggested that he should have temporarily suspended his authority while he sought psychological help. But the current state of public feeling about a president seeking therapy worked against any such suggestion. Hillary Clinton's statement in the summer of 1999, for example, that the president's behavior grew out of a troubled childhood, did not sit well with the public. While it was acceptable for the president to seek religious counseling in the midst of such troubles, there was little sympathy for the idea of a president in psychotherapy. As recently as 1972, Thomas Eagleton's record of emotional problems was enough to force him out of the election for vice president. The fact that Eagleton felt compelled to hide his medical history speaks volumes about the continuing conviction that a candidate for national office must represent himself as without significant health problems of any kind. Now, I certainly don't wish to make the case for presidential and vice presidential candidates who suffer from depression or any other serious psychological illness. But since even the healthiest of public officials can succumb to the pressures of their offices, shouldn't we accept the proposition that treatment of such problems with therapy and medication, if needed, makes more sense than hiding them from public view? This recounting of presidential health problems, physical and psychological, suggests to me a need for changes in public policy that can protect the country against the kind of medical difficulties we faced with Wilson, Coolidge, FDR, Eisenhower, LBJ, Nixon, Reagan, and now Clinton. We can little afford to continue to turn a blind eye to physical or psychological problems that to one extent or another limited a president's capacity to function with full effectiveness. But what is to be done? There are no simple answers. I have 2 suggestions. I don't know whether they're worth a damn, but I'll put them before you anyway. 2 suggestions that might be useful starting points in a national dialogue on presidential disability. First, might it not make sense to establish an independent White House medical office to monitor presidential health? Unquestionably, presidents will feel threatened by an independent medical group sitting in judgment on their capacity to govern. Comparisons will surely be invoked to the independent counsel law, which Congress allowed to expire out of a conviction that it did not work very well or that such an office provides an opportunity for a political assault on a president. Some, if not much of this concern, however, could be alleviated by giving presidents the power, as with Supreme Court appointments, to select 5 members of the office with the advice and consent of the Senate. Those chosen and approved would serve for the duration of a president's term. The American Medical, Psychiatric, and Psychological Associations might be asked to provide guidelines on what constitutes presidential incapacity. The panel might also want to consider the standards used by large corporations for assuring that CEOs relinquish their authority when they are medically or psychologically incapacitated. The objective, of course, is to insulate medical and judgments as much as possible from political bias. Just as law stands above all men, or the law stands above all men, so pronouncements on presidential health should be as objective as humanly possible. But even if we can assure a substantial measure of objectivity, the panel should have only advisory powers. It could not oust a president from office. If it believed that a president's health made him unfit to continue his duties, it could recommend to the president and the Congress that he step aside, either temporarily or permanently. This, I emphasize, is simply a suggestion. I hope one of many that might come before a congressional committee looking into the question of how to deal with presidential disability. Beyond this, it seems apparent that a key to facilitating the use of the 25th Amendment in temporarily replacing a president is to raise public confidence in vice presidents. As with judgments on presidential health, this is no simple matter. Traditionally, the office of vice president has been a political burying ground. John Adams called it the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived or his imagination conceived. Woodrow Wilson asserted that, quote, in explaining how little there is to be said about it, one has evidently said all there is to say, unquote. Wilson's VP, Thomas Marshall, was fond of the story about the woman who had twin sons. One became a sea captain and went off to sea, and the other a vice president. Neither was ever heard from again. John Nance Garner, FDR's first vice president, declared the office to be not worth a warm pitcher of spit. Theodore Roosevelt was elevated to the office by Republican Party bosses who wanted to wrest the New York governorship from him and were eager to end his political career. It is not a stepping stone to anything except oblivion, TR complained. Lyndon Johnson, the consummate political activist who said he never thought about politics more than 18 hours a day, despised every minute of his do-nothing vice presidency. Still, for all this, there remain great doubts about vice presidents and their competence to step up to the much more demanding challenges of the presidency. John Quincy Adams warned that the succession of a vice president would place, quote, in the executive chair a man never thought of for it by anybody, unquote. Surely one low point in the history of the vice presidency came in 1908 when William Jennings Bryan, the Democratic nominee for president, chose the 81-year-old millionaire Henry G. Davis as his running mate. Since the Democrats found it almost impossible to raise much money that year, fewer than 350 people in the country contributed more than $100 to Bryan's quote-unquote barefoot campaign, as it was called. The party hoped by nominating this millionaire Davis, they hoped that the wealthy octogenarian would pick up the tab, but he was a skinflint and they were sorely disappointed. The cynical nomination of someone so unsuited to become president demonstrated the low regard in which the vice presidency was then held. I am less concerned about the ability of vice presidents to acquit their responsibilities than with the continuing reluctance of presidents and vice presidents to confront difficult choices about presidential incapacity. Certainly, presidential nominees who choose running mates more for their potential as effective presidents than for their supposed help in winning elections can score immediate points with the electorate. Beyond this, presidents will want to give their VPs larger responsibilities than historically has been the case. Jimmy Carter's reliance on Walter Mondale and Bill Clinton's use of Al Gore for major tasks is a valuable precedent that future chief executives will or should want to emulate. As important, presidents need to remember that the national well-being must always come first. No president would deny the proposition, but it is belied by presidential actions. When Wilson, Coolidge, FDR, Eisenhower, LBJ, and Reagan refused to consider any temporary or longer-term suspension of their authority on the assumption that to do so meant undermining the country's sense of political stability, they were also protecting their presidential reputations. Lyndon Johnson, for example, believed in the Vietnam War, but he also kept insisting that he was not going to be the first president in U.S. history to lose a war. Johnson, in other words, could not separate the public good from his personal concerns. And so I think it has been with most presidents. The solution to the American dilemma over presidential disability, then, may best be found not in far-reaching institutional changes at the vice presidential level, but in the ability of presidents to step back and put national needs above their own. The powers of the presidential office and the large egos of those who believe themselves suited for the job make it difficult for them to give vice presidents significant work that will promote public confidence in them. But presidents, always keeping their mortality in mind, should anticipate a possible succession by giving greater forethought to the selection of running mates and to their schooling for the day they may have to assume command. Even more difficult than the vice presidential problem is the reluctance of presidents to step aside when afflicted by medical problems. They need the help of detached experts in a White House medical office. The innovative spirit that moved us to add 25 wise amendments to the Constitution and only one unsuccessful one should inform a concerted effort to meet the national dilemma of presidential disability before we confront another, more disturbing crisis over a disabled president who jeopardizes the national well-being by failing to step aside. Thank you for being so attentive and honest.
You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Democrat Chet Atkins served four terms as a congressman representing the old 5th District, and prior to that he was chair of the House Ways and Means Committee on Beacon Hill. He's currently working in the financial industry. In his elected role, he served on ethics committees in both Beacon Hill and Washington. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Ted.
The proposals. The medical panel to monitor the health of a president with the advice and consent of the Senate. These people would be chosen, picked by the president. Your response to that?
Well, I think it's creating a Rube Goldberg device to solve a problem that really doesn't exist. The interesting thing in Professor Dalek's lecture, which is almost a Perils of Pauline on presidential disability, turns out how well the situation has worked. Even when Reagan had onset of Alzheimer's, when Roosevelt had enormous congestive heart failure, even Woodrow Wilson on his deathbed after a stroke, the system has worked. The system has worked really remarkably well throughout our history. And this system that he would set up with this medical panel and trying to quantify, take the subjective out of the process of presidential disability is just insanity, particularly when you include the psychological factors that he wants to include. Anybody who's been to a psychiatric or a convention of the American Psychological Association, these guys can't even decide what determines deviance. And they change it about every year. They change the definition of deviance. How are they going to ever deal with presidential behavior?
So I sense that as an elected official who has worked in the system, you don't think that that's workable.
I think it's insanity. And then his thought of, you know, that presidents, when they're dealing with depression, should take a time out and seek counseling and temporarily relinquish their powers of office is just nuttiness.
Well, all right. But there are those historians and others who maintain that President Roosevelt, for example, was so incapacitated by his illnesses that at Yalta he gave away half of Eastern Europe.
First of all, that isn't correct. Roosevelt wasn't acting alone at Yalta. Roosevelt and Churchill were dealing with an extraordinarily difficult situation at the end of World War II. And so it's I think, convenient for people who take a particular view of history to say that Yalta was a giveaway. But even given that, can you imagine during the Roosevelt presidency, in the middle of World War II, having a medical panel determine that Roosevelt was unfit to serve in office? But hey, folks, it's just our advice and our view, and we'll let Congress handle it. That creates an enormous workshop for mischief. And the one thing that I am, I would say, a little bit of an expert on is the mischief that Congress can do. And essentially, what this does is it puts the medical panel and that they would advise Congress in a process of removal. And my God, we just watched how Congress bungled the issue of impeachment and used it for entirely political purposes. Can you imagine opening it up to things like depression? Can you imagine a group of psychiatrists in the middle of the Civil War saying President Lincoln suffers severe depression and, you know, therefore should be removed from office? Nuts.
How then do we determine whether a president is unfit? Or is it left to the president himself to make that decision?
Well, to some extent, it's left to the president himself, or in the future, one would hope perhaps herself at some point to make the decision. But the American public and the media has such an enormous influence that if there were a president who was operating, who was incapacitated, and it was affecting the conduct of public affairs, there would be such a hue and cry and such a drumbeat of pressure that the president would, in fact, be forced to give up their office. And that's essentially what happened to Nixon at Watergate.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ted.
Next, a former official of the Reagan administration offers his views of the proposal. Boston University Law Dean Ron Cass served on the International Trade Commission in both the Reagan and Bush administrations. Under George Bush, he was vice chair. He was also an advisor to the FCC in the Reagan administration. Dean Cass, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
As a veteran of Washington and government service, what's your response to Professor Dalek's proposal?
I think that Professor Dalek has given us a very interesting historical analysis with a lot of learning about the way the presidency works, a lot of learning about the sort of disabilities that presidents encountered. I think the proposal he has put on the table is one that is unlikely to ever get acceptance from a president. They're not notorious for wanting to have physicians selected by others examining them. They're not notorious for wanting information about their private lives to be public. We can see in the current administration indications of a president who is not going out of his way to make his private activities public knowledge. I think that the likelihood of getting Professor Dalek's solution in place is quite remote.
Oh, but what about the problems themselves? I mean, how are we to know when a president is incapable of doing his or her job?
I thought that's why we elected them. It is really the case, I think, that a president is a political creature. He's elected politically. He's responsive politically. And any attempt to try to get him to be corralled by apolitical forces is almost of necessity doomed to failure.
You served in the Reagan administration, and since the president's retirement after two successful terms, hints have come out that perhaps he was operating at less than full capacity toward the latter part of his second administration. Would you have any knowledge of that? And if so, do you think it was handled properly?
It's not something I saw. My sense of the president when I saw him was that he was engaged and in control. He was always someone who was more comfortable giving general directions and letting people carry out the specifics. The people I know who are closer to him than I never have said that they thought he had early signs of Alzheimer's. It may be something that people will simply disagree on. I know I have Alzheimer's in my family, and whenever I can't remember something, I worry whether this is an early sign of that. My doctor says as long as I'm worried, that's a good sign.
Well, and finally, Dean, what about the second suggestion, that is building up the vice presidency so that there's greater confidence in it and that a natural succession could occur and people would be comfortable with that?
If you read Shakespeare's plays, you see a lot of kings who are worried about building up possible successors. I think that Shakespeare was on to something in that. There are presidents who will have a really good working relationship with their vice president. Those are likely to be exceptional.
My thanks to both Chet Atkins and to Law Dean Ron Kass. They've been our guests as we respond to Professor Dalek's proposal based on his university lecture, Presidential Disability, an American Dilemma. You've been listening to an archive edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. Our guests were Professor Robert Dalek, former Congressman Chet Atkins, and Law Dean Ron Kass. Join us next week for the annual Martin Luther King Day address from George Sherman Union, followed by a roundtable discussion of the status of African Americans in 2001. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-WBUR. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Glenn Alexander and Mitch Wortlieb. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for being with us.